Now, for those of you that have, I'm only using this microphone because they're taping, so it's not because I have this incredible desire to hear my voice magnified.
I can't hear you.
It's not because I need to hear my voice magnified. For those of you that have been in the network that I'm teaching, which is obviously meeting in the morning. The material that I'm discussing here today is material that I discussed there yesterday. And so, trying to make sure that no one is, expectations are foiled, you'll appreciate, hopefully, the fact that we're at least trying to be sensitive so that people don't necessarily reduplicate if they don't, have a desire to hear it again. So, what I want to talk to you about today is planning, and I think. Let's see if I can find my. I think the topic for today, to me, is one of the most practical of all the things that I talk about because it's just so useful. The model that we have developed on planning is one that I probably use in one form or another every day. And it's so helpful to me because it enables me to get perspective on the things that I'm doing, whether it's a luncheon meeting or a breakfast meeting, whether it's a special activity that our organization is planning where we're bringing several hundred people together for the opportunity of ministering and the ways that we minister to those organizations. If I'm speaking at a church or speaking to a Sunday school class, I use this model. Sue, my wife, and I use it all the time in terms of the way we relate to one another and to the people that God has brought into our lives, our own children. We kind of use various aspects of this model. So I think you'll find it to be very, very practical, not just in terms of your ministry, but in terms of the way you live life and experience life. So I love talking about this, and I think you'll find it enjoyable as well. So that's kind of the introduction to planning. Let's pray and ask the Lord's blessing upon our time together. Father, it's just so good to be here, and we thank you again and again and again for the joy of being able to be with brothers and sisters in Christ, those with whom we shall enjoy your presence together forever. And we thank you for the bit of foretaste that you give us of glory being in Chopron these days. It's so good to be together. We sit here from different countries. We come from different backgrounds. We have all been redeemed because of what it is that you did on our behalf on Calvary. And we just thank you for the life we have in Christ, and we thank you for the universality of the body of Christ, that we can come from so many different places and enjoy being one because of what it is that you've done. So we pray, Heavenly Father, for our brothers and sisters that are here representing so many different ministries and organizations, that the Chopron experience of 2004 might be one that would not only provide us encouragement, it would provide us hope, expand our vision, give us the technical skills that we need to even be better at what it is that you've called us to do, and that we might leave here with a new sense of energy, realizing that we're not alone in this task, but that we come together for a common purpose of reaching people in the ways that you intended with a message, the precious, redeeming, life-changing message of the gospel of Jesus Christ. So we just commit this time to you, ask your blessing upon it, for we pray in Christ's name. Amen. I usually start this discussion by drawing a horizontal line on the board, and I call that line the attitude continuum. There are two extremes to the attitude continuum. People within your organization are somewhere on that attitude continuum, be it members of your church, members of the organization that you represent, donors to your ministries who financially support what it is that you're doing. They're somewhere on this line, somewhere on the attitude continuum. On one extreme, I'm going to write the word cynicism because there are some people that are kind of cynical about your organization. when the word comes up or the name comes up of your organization, they may just kind of shrug their shoulders and say, oh, yeah, I know about them, or I've heard about them, or whatever the case might be. On the other side, you have people that feel totally different. They're, if you were to use a word to describe them, you'd say they're euphoric. You know, literally, they are so excited about your ministry. They feel very, very strongly about what it is that you do. They feel very, very committed and enthusiastic about what it is they know about you and so forth. I mean, we all, in conjunction with any variety of relationships that we enjoy, we all are somewhere on the attitude continuum. You're on the attitude continuum in a variety of different settings in which we might be able to define. For example, if I were to ask you to put a dot somewhere on that line, somewhere between cynicism and euphoria, as it relates to the relationship you have with your church, where would you put your dot? In other words, we all are involved in a local church somewhere, and we all benefit to varying degrees as it relates to the ministry of that church. So you may put yourself on the line, you may put yourself perhaps on the south, what I call the south side of the attitude continuum, maybe towards cynicism, certainly not cynical, but feeling some level of reservation as it relates to the ministry because it's not perhaps ministering to you in ways that you might have anticipated. Or you might find yourself over here somewhere, and that's fine. Or you may find yourself at either extreme, which oftentimes is doubtful because, at least on the cynical side, because most people, you know, leave before they allow themselves to reside too long on the cynical side. Unless they are, interestingly enough, what I've discovered, if they're denominational people, in other words, I've been a Lutheran all my life. My father was a Lutheran, my grandfather was a Lutheran, my great-great-great-great-great-grandfather was Martin Luther, and so the realities are I'm a Lutheran, and I'm going to die a Lutheran, and I'm in a Lutheran church, and you know, they're cynical about the church, but they refuse to leave. And so they just kind of sit there and they occupy space. And maybe you're in a situation like that, or you've been in situations like that where you find people that are kind of there, and they basically occupy space. But in terms of what it is they contribute, if they contribute anything positively, it's pretty minimal. Now, you could put yourself on the line as it relates to the relationship you have with the organization that sent you here. Let's say that it's not your church, but you represent another organization, or you support an organization, a ministry that you really believe in. You could put yourself on a line there. You could even put yourself a dot on the line as it relates to the relationship you have with your spouse. And it may be that you're towards euphoria, or it may be that you're somewhat in the middle or whatever, but we are, all of us, on the attitude continuum in a variety of places as it relates to the variety of relationships that we enjoy with others. Now, let me just suggest to you that while there are extremes, there are steps that lead to cynicism. So let's assume, for the sake of illustration, that this middle line here represents kind of a neutral position. You just visit a church and you decide to make that church your church home. So you and your wife move into an area, you kind of visit a bunch of churches, and then you finally decide on a church that you feel is probably the best church for you, given what it is that you perceive your needs to be and so forth. And so you go to that church. So you have neither strong impressions one way or the other. You're just kind of walking in and you're being a part of this for the first time. There are three steps that lead to cynicism. And it's important that you understand these steps. First of all, you have what I call, you know, discouragement. That's the first step in the road towards cynicism, is people become discouraged. They have expectations, and sometimes those expectations aren't realized, and so they become a bit discouraged. They think, my gracious, I kind of hoped that something was going to happen here, but, you know, it didn't. And so they become discouraged. If discouragement is left undealt with, then the next step is frustration. And it's usually expressed by words that would go something like, well, don't they see it? I mean, you know, here are, you know, is an obvious need that's not being addressed. What's wrong with them, usually speaking to the administration or people who have the potential of changing things, and they say, what's wrong? I mean, they become frustrated because they can't see any meaningful change taking place as it relates to something that is very obvious to them as a deficiency. Then following frustration, if frustration is not dealt with, then people become apathetic. They experience apathy. In other words, they say, if they don't care, why should I? In other words, if nobody else seems to be concerned about this, I guess this is the way it is, and so they just become apathetic about it too. And then if apathy is left undetected or undealt with, then eventually it will come become cynicism. Now, there are three steps also that lead to euphoria. One is encouragement. Then you have hope. You know, people become hopeful when they see things happen. Then all of a sudden they realize that maybe some of their dreams, some of their vision as it relates to how that ministry might impact their lives, they become very, very hopeful, you know, and almost moving towards enthusiasm, because when hope, you know, is fulfilled, then people become enthusiastic. So there's enthusiasm. And as enthusiasm is fed by positive things, then they become almost euphoric. So now you see the various dimensions of the attitude continuum, and everybody is on it. There's a couple of things that I think, and the reason why I think this is an important introduction to strategic planning is because there are two reasons or two things that need to be pointed out as it relates to the attitude continuum, and both of them have strategic planning or planning dimensions. The first thing that I want you to note as you're thinking about this is that where anyone is on the attitude continuum is predicated on their perception of their ability, of your ability as an organization to do what it is that you say you're going to do. Okay? Now, let me repeat that. Where anyone is on the attitude continuum is predicated on their perception of your organizationally, your ability to do what it is that you say you're going to do. Now, for example, if someone found themselves on the south side of the attitude continuum, as it related to one of the scenarios that I suggested, basically, they had expectations from that organization. Whether they were realistic or not is not really the point. They had expectations from that relationship that weren't realized, and so they become discouraged or frustrated, or perhaps apathetic if those continued not to be addressed. The second thing that I think is very, very important to note is that where anyone is on the attitude continuum in conjunction with the organization of which you're a part, the reality is you've probably placed them there. In other words, we can't absolve ourselves of any responsibility as leaders of organizations as it relates to the attitudes of people that are associated with us. For example, your children are on the attitude continuum. If you have children, you know, they're somewhere on the attitude continuum as it relates to the family. You know, some of them are kind of cynical about the family because they may have expectations as it relates to how they feel the family should relate to one another pertaining to their needs. And if they're not experiencing that to the degree that they anticipate it, they're going to become, you know, discouraged or frustrated. Now, maybe their expectations are unrealistic. That's not the point. The point is their expectations were not realized. Now, the reason why I begin all of this, or I use this as we begin a discussion on planning is, you know, what is a strategic plan for an organization? It's a statement, isn't it? It's a statement that says, in essence, here's where we're going. And we tell people, here are our plans for the future, here are the steps that we're going to take to move us from where it is we are to where it is we need to be, and this is our plan. Now, some people, when they see that plan or read it for the first time, what are they going to say? Yeah, fat chance that that's going to happen. I mean, if I've heard something in the past, I've heard it, you know, I'm hearing it again, and the realities are it's just probably not going to happen. And so consequently, you know, on the basis of what it is they've experienced in the past, they basically receive what it is you're telling them with a measure of caution, if not, you know, just downright opposition.
Okay, so kind of keep this in the back of your mind. I'm going to erase at least the words. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to, just on the top of the whiteboard here, just draw a line with two extremes. And we all know that that line represents the attitude continuum, because it seems to me that it needs to be at the backdrop of our discussion on planning. Realizing that, you know, what it is that we say, what it is that we prepare our organization to do is going to impact or be impacted. Our ability to accomplish it is going to be impacted by where people are on this continuum, this attitude continuum. Now, before we talk about planning, I think it's important to talk about various philosophies that exist out there as it relates to planning, because there are three prevailing philosophies that exist as it relates to organizational planning in most Christian ministries today. One philosophy of planning is that we shouldn't. In other words, you know, a lot of people just don't believe in planning. I could introduce to you some Christian leaders, many of whom you would recognize by name, people who know the Lord, who love the Lord, and who have spent many years of their life serving the Lord, who don't believe in planning. And in fact, if you were to ask them, why don't you believe in planning, most of them would probably quote a passage from Matthew chapter 6. You know, don't take any thought for tomorrow, because tomorrow's got enough concerns of its own. Seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you. I've talked to many of these people, and they said, I don't want to miss anything that God wants to do, so I don't want to plan it because I don't want to miss something. Well, you know, I think the Bible says a lot about planning, and Jesus said a lot about planning that wasn't necessarily relinquished to what it is that he said in Matthew chapter 6. Jesus also said, don't go out to build a tower without first of all counting the cost, or don't go to battle without first of all knowing the strength of the enemy, all of which imply, you know, planning. And then other biblical writers under the inspiration of the Spirit talk about the importance of planning. James says, don't go out and build barns without first of all realizing that, you know, your life may end tomorrow. So planning for the future without taking into consideration the will of God is not necessarily the best form of planning. So planning is mentioned frequently in the Scriptures. But, you know, one of the things that I've noticed about people who don't believe in planning, and see if you haven't experienced this as well, because I know some of you have met people that don't believe in planning, at least whether they say it overtly or they just don't do it. But you know what I've discovered about most of them? They all have calendars. We have a very popular calendar in America, a company that, you know, kind of dresses up calendars and makes them attractive to sale or for sale, and a lot of people buy them, and they come in nice binders and so forth, and they're called day timers. And basically, they're just diaries of sorts, which are planning instruments for organizations or for individuals. And what I've discovered, actually, in sitting at tables with people who tell me across the table that they don't believe in planning, that right next to them is a day timer. And oftentimes I find a level of satisfaction in asking if I could look at their day timer. I says, can I look at your day timer? They said, oh, sure. And I'll go up about 2 or 3 months, and I'll notice that they've got things written on their calendar 2 or 3 months from now, which obviously implies that they have planned to do something in 2 or 3 months. And so they're not even consistent with their own philosophy, because the realities are, if you've planned something beyond this day, in other words, if you know where you're going to eat tonight, and if you know, you know, where you're going to be next weekend, the realities are you're probably a planner. So I think we all plan, and I'm not sure that anyone who says they don't believe in planning is really consistent with the philosophy that they articulate. There's another view of planning which is probably more prominent, and I believe the most prominent form of a philosophy of planning that's practiced in Christian ministries today, and that's called consensual planning. Now, consensual planning is basically bringing a group of people together and trying to develop some kind of consensus, something we can all agree on. And so we're talking about planning for our organization, and I suggest something, and Frank says, oh, I think that's a bad idea. And Tom or Tim says, yeah, I agree. I don't think that's a good idea. And so consequently, you know, we say, okay, well, I guess that's probably not a good idea, and we go on,
Richard says he comes up with an idea, and we say, well, that's pretty good. And Frank says, I don't think so. So all of a sudden, Richard's idea is kind of poo-pooed, and we kind of continue on until finally we can come up with something that we can all agree on, we all feel good about, and that becomes the basis of our plan. In our country, and I suspect that it's been somewhat more widely spread because I used this illustration the other day, and many people were at least aware of the model that is frequently used to facilitate this form of planning very popularly around the world, is a model that is kind of articulated by an acronym called SWOT, S-W-O-T. Have any of you heard that? S stands for strengths, W stands for weaknesses, O stands for opportunities, and T stands for threats. So if I were facilitating a planning process using the SWOT acronym, typically what I would do is I'd have a tripod up here, okay? And I would have some butcher paper on it, and I'd say, okay, let's talk about the strengths of our organization. So you'd begin to tell me about your strengths, and I'd write them down. And we might think of maybe 50 or 60 strengths, you know, things that we recognize as being a real strength of our organization. So I write them all down. Maybe I fill up two or three sheets of paper. And as I fill up a sheet of paper, I tack it on the wall over here. So we've got three sheets of paper just listing strengths. And I do the same with weaknesses. I do the same with opportunities, and I do the same with threats. And so now we have 12 pieces of paper tacked to the wall or scotch taped to the wall around us, each listing either a strength, a weakness, an opportunity that faces us, or a threat that might prevent us from being able to do what it is that we'd like to do. The next thing I would do is I'd give you some Monopoly money, some play money. And let's say I give you $10,000. And I say, okay, here's what I'd like you to do. I'd like you to spend the $10,000 on something that you see written on one of the papers that are scotch-taped to the wall. But here are the rules. You cannot spend more than $1,000 on anything that you see here, and you can't spend less than $250, and you have to spend all $10,000. So you understand the rules. I give you a magic marker, and I say, okay, everybody up. And so you walk around the room, and you're kind of looking at all the things that are written down, and you see something. You see a strength, and you say, well, that's a very noteworthy strength. And I think, you know, we as an organization need to build on that strength because it's one of the things that we're best known for. And so you spend, let's say, $1,000 on that strength. You spend $250 here and $500 here or whatever, but you spend all $10,000. I come around with the old calculator, and I start adding up how money was spent. And those things where the most money was spent, I put at the top of the list, okay? And we kind of take a descending list where we have five or six items where the majority of money that was spent by people participating in the process devoted, you know, their attention. Those become the planning initiatives. Those are the things that we're going to do. These are the things we're really going to focus our attention in, and our plan tends to revolve around those six things. Now, some of you are saying, well, gee, that sounds kind of interesting. You know, obviously, it does reflect consensually what we all probably agree on, in essence, that we need to do. But there are two problems from my perspective with that particular scenario. The first problem is that what it is that shows up on these six initiatives that we've listed on the whiteboard that are the result of the ways in which you spent your money, that's the consensus of this group, okay? In other words, if I were to bring another group from the same organization together the next day and do the same thing, it might be that I come up with an entirely different list. And so it represents the consensus of a group, but not necessarily the consensus of the entire constituency. So there are going to be some people that are not going to agree with the initiatives that you create. But the second problem with the approach that I've just suggested is that it lacks a focal point. Now stop and think about that. It has no destination. In other words, it seems to me that a plan needs to take us from some place to another place, and that destination needs to be quite clear. And so consequently, here's a planning model that doesn't take you anywhere. It's necessarily, or it may in fact be, only reproducing mediocrity Because what in essence you're doing is you're looking at what it is you're doing, and if what it is you're currently doing isn't taking you or moving you closer to a desired destination, then all you're doing is you're just kind of muddling the waters by reproducing what it is that's not being effective already. So as a planning model, I think it's a poor one. Now, I do think there's probably some value in SWOT at some point in time in the planning process, but as a model to direct the process, I think it's a poor one. There's an interesting example, I think, of consensual planning in the Scriptures. It's in Numbers chapter 13. Remember Numbers chapter 13? Moses sends out 12 guys to search out the land. They go for 40 days and 40 nights. They come back. You know, everybody says, well, what's it like? They said, oh, man, it's wonderful. It's a land that flows over with milk and honey. In fact, we have some of the fruit of it, and they brought some fruit back from the land to show the people, and everybody's obviously in awe as they see the beautiful fruit that was grown in this land that God had promised them so many years before. But then they go on. Oh, my word, there's people that live in that area. And these people live in huge cities that are perched on high hills and are surrounded by thick walls. And, oh, by the way, they're not normal people. These people were giants. And we were just grasshoppers, you know, in their sight. And so you know what happened. Numbers chapter 14. You know, the next morning, the Wilderness Gazette comes out, the local newspaper, the early edition, there in 100-point type. You hear it, you know, poll results. 85% of the spies are opposed to going into the land. They took a survey and God lost. The whole point is in Numbers chapter 14, what was the consensus of the group? Let's find ourselves a captain. Let's go back to Egypt. Was that God's will? No, it wasn't God's will. In fact, the people that were willing to contend for God's will, namely Joshua and Caleb, were basically putting at risk their very lives because the attitude of the people was, let's stone them with stones. Let's keep these guys quiet because we're going to listen to the majority. So consensual planning, I don't think, is necessarily a good model to follow as far as organizational planning. It's not a bad idea to have buy-in from people. I'm not suggesting that that's not important, but I am suggesting that I think that needs to occur within the construct of another model. Frank, did you have a question?
You said that it's the consensus of the group, but not of the organization.
Right. The two reasons why I thought it was weak was because it represented the consensus of a group, which is okay. But the realities are, if another group from the same organization were to come together the next day, you might come up with a total different set of conclusions as to what was important. And the second one was that it lacks focus. You know, and I think that's really the key point, that it's not really taking you anywhere. In other words, you're not looking at a destination and trying to figure out how you can most effectively and efficiently get there. And I think that's one of the things that a strategic plan should do. Now, the third model for planning is what I call the directive model. And the directive model, quite frankly, is that I just believe that leaders should lead. You know, it's kind of an interesting focus, I suspect, but if God's placed you in a position of leadership, either as the director of an organization or a member of its board, if you have a responsibility to lead, then I think it's the responsibility of you to do just that. And I think there's a real tendency in our culture to shy away from taking on responsibility, because when we take on responsibility, we take on accountability. And most of us don't want to be accountable to anything. We would rather pass it off. I think one of the real values, at least in the perception of people who follow the consensus model, is that nobody has to take responsibility for anything. It's the consensus of the group, and we can kind of pass it off and say, well, gee, I thought it was a bad idea, but it was Frank's idea, and, you know, we all like Frank, and, you know, certainly Frank's a nice guy, and so we tend to, you know, want to, you know, pass it off to someone else. Yes, Richard?
It's a big problem in Japanese. Everything is done on the consensus.
Yeah, exactly.
Nobody carries the buck.
yet no one carries the role. Although, interestingly enough, when something fails, who's the first person to quit or to shoot himself? You know, it's the director. It's the CEO of the company who takes on the responsibility of the consensus of the group, regardless of whether or not he's the one that's personally responsible, which is really kind of interesting in that particular culture. But, you know, it's my belief that leaders should lead, you know, I realize that may not be necessarily a popular notion, you know, in our society today, but it's certainly one that's, I think, holds a lot of biblical precedent. You know, there's a movie out recently in America. I don't know if you've seen it around in your part of the world, but the movie is entitled We Were Soldiers, and it's a war movie, which tend to have appeal to Americans at various times. I suspect they like to relish in the past or whatever and kind of think about some of the victories of the past as well as, you know, what it is that's happening these days. And but nonetheless, it's a war movie, and it goes back to the Vietnam era, which wasn't really a particular popular era of American political history, but anyway, the player, the main actor in this movie is Mel Gibson. And he's a lieutenant colonel that is getting ready to lead a group of men to Vietnam to go to battle. And so it's a story of this platoon of men that are getting ready to go into battle. And right before they're getting ready to go, there's a scene. It's a very moving scene, actually, where these men are marching on to what appears to be a school soccer field or something. You know, they're kind of walking on. There's some bleachers, and in the bleachers are parents, extended family members of the soldiers that are about ready to be deployed. And they're sitting and watching. It's kind of their last farewell to their loved one, and some apprehension, I suspect, in terms of whether or not they're ever going to see them again. And so they march onto the field. They're all standing at attention. The commanding general speaks on behalf of the army or whatever, and then Mel Gibson stands up. He's the leader that's going to take them into battle. He stands up and he says, "Well, we're going to go into battle." And he says, "There's three things that I want you to know," or two things. He says, number one, he says, "When we get into battle, we're going to go to a battlefield, and there's going to be a helicopter that's going to take us to the battlefield. It's going to land on the battlefield, and I just want you to know something. When the helicopter lands," he says, "I'm going to be the first guy out." Okay, you're kind of listening to that. And he says, "And when the battle is over," he said, "the helicopters are going to come back and get us. And when the helicopter lands," he says, "I want you to know something." He says, "I'm going to be the last guy in. And no, we're going to leave no one behind." Now stop it. I mean, that's really a kind of a testament in leadership, is it not? I mean, here he is. He says, "I'm going to be the first guy out." Well, you know, if I'm thinking to myself, you know, I'm on that helicopter. You know what I'm looking for? I'm looking for four pretty good husky guys. I'm going to put one in front of me, one in back of me, one on either side of me, and I'm going to walk off that helicopter like this. You know, I want to be protected, but the first guy out is the guy that's going to take the shots. And I think one of the reasons why we're so reluctant to lead is we're really fearful in leading, because if we make a mistake, then people are going to point their finger at us, and that's not necessarily a comfortable position to be in. But the realities are, I suspect that if I were sitting in the bleachers, and I had that occasion in my life, where my son was being deployed and sent off to a foreign country to represent his country in a war. And I sat there and watched my son, and I had that apprehension. Well, if I were sitting in that particular scenario, there's a part of me that would have been glad that he was going with Mel. You know, the assurance that he was going with a leader that was going to lead, and he might make mistakes, but the realities are I had confidence in the leader. As it was in the case of my son, I had confidence in his leader as well, and he did come back safely. But we didn't know when he left. We didn't know if we'd ever see him again. So the directive model, while it's an uncomfortable model at one level, it's still essentially the most effective model, and I believe it's the biblical model. Now, before we talk about planning, there's a few other things that I'd like to share with you. First of all, there are four reasons why plans typically fail. You know, it's interesting that 88% of the organizations of the type that you represent, okay, 88%
of the organizations of the type that you represent do not have a strategic plan. They don't have a plan for the future. The majority of churches don't have plans. The majority of ministries you represent don't have a strategic plan. Interestingly enough, if you were to ask them why they don't have a strategic plan, you know what they'd tell you? Well, we did that once. And they'll actually refer back to a time when there were people that were involved in the planning process. They worked in many instances months and certainly weeks and sometimes months producing a plan. And at the end of the period of time, they produced a document. If you were asked them to see the document, many of them could produce it. They might have to look for it for 15 or 20 minutes. And, they'll eventually find it either holding open a door or, back in the back dredges of a filing cabinet or whatever. And they'll bring it to you, and while it looks nice, the realities are it was totally irrelevant. And what I mean by irrelevant is that the moment the plan was produced, everyone that looked at it saw it as something that was never going to amount to anything because it basically was perceived from the very beginning as being something that the organization neither had the resources or the constituency had the interest in pursuing. And so consequently, it just kind of got tossed away, and the exercise was perceived as being futile. Well, there are four reasons why plans typically fail, and the majority of them will fail. And so that's why a lot of organizations don't even bother. Why bother if what we're going to do is just going to be a wasted effort? And let me tell you why they fail. Number one is the majority of plans, and this is probably the primary reason, the majority of plans are created in a vacuum. And what I mean is a kind of a financial vacuum. The realities are every plan that you will ever produce, every plan that is ever produced is going to require resources in order to be accomplished. You're going to need money. There's probably a building or two or a new program that's going to require an investment on behalf of the organization in order to be able to accomplish. I mean, money may be required in order to accomplish the plan. You're going to need people. You're going to have to engage people as volunteers and supporters to help implement certain aspects of the plan. So you're going to need people, and you're going to need an appropriate amount of time, a realistic amount of time to accomplish certain objectives. And if people realize that the resources that would be required in order to be able to accomplish the plan are not there, is there a realistic possibility that they ever will be there, then basically the plan is tossed because it's perceived as irrelevant. It's a great idea, but there's just no way that it's ever going to happen. So the primary reason why plans fail is because they're created in a resource vacuum, for lack of a better term. Number two reason why they fail is because we get the wrong planners. There's a problem with asking for volunteers. Have you ever realized that? One of the problems in asking for volunteers is sometimes we get them. And then we realize, what in the world are we going to do with them? Because we look at the people that volunteered to serve in various capacities where we kind of threw out the net and they responded, and all of a sudden we realize that here's a person that we've, used as a volunteer before in certain capacities, and, whenever they've been involved in something, it just kind of ends up in disaster. They cause dissension, they cause a level of criticism. They tend to take a very critical attitude towards things, and so rather than being a positive contributor to the process, they tend to be kind of a divider, somebody that just is not necessarily a very productive member of a planning team. Yes. Oh, absolutely. Well, I'm going to talk about that. Okay, let's see if we don't answer that question. Because I think it's very important. If these are the three reasons or the four reasons why plans fail, then it seems to me that we need to keep those in the back of our mind and plan accordingly, not to make the mistakes that are going to produce a plan that doesn't really amount to anything in terms of its ability to move you forward. A third reason why plans fail is we don't create an agenda for planning. In other words, we're too nebulous when we deal with planners in explaining to them what it is we want them to do. In other words, we'd like you to plan our curriculum. And they say, well,
What exactly is it that you want me to do? Well, just plan the curriculum that will enable us to accomplish what it is we want to do here. And I don't know how to do that, or can you give me some guidelines? And they say, no, that's why we've got you doing it. And so basically you give them a job to do, and you don't give them a direction, or you don't give them parameters in which to think. And so they tend to kind of go off on their own, and sometimes they really go off into areas that you never expected them to go. And then you're left with something that you're going to have to either accept, and it may not be consistent with your mission, or you're going to have to reject and turn off the people that prepared it. And now you have people on the attitude continuum that are down in the cynical side, because basically you've just rejected all the recommendations that they made that they feel are in your best interest. Then the fourth reason why plans fail is because we lose control of the process. When I was a kid, I used to watch cartoons, and there was always, and I suspect you've all watched cartoons as well, but there was always a cartoon scenario that I remember. You know, it's the train kind of chugging up the mountain, you know, and it gets almost to the top of the mountain, and there, near the top of the mountain, the brakes give out. And all of a sudden, the train starts rushing down the hill to the idyllic little village below. And you kind of know there's going to be a disaster, you know, at the end of the, at the bottom of the hill. And all the time the train's going down, you're just kind of hoping it's not going to be real bad, you know. But usually it's a pretty bad disaster, at least in a cartoon. All the buildings are all just destroyed. Or unless the rescuer of the cartoon, you know, Bugs Bunny or somebody comes out and stops it all or whatever. But the point is that's the way a lot of planning processes are. You know, all of a sudden what was intended to be a very good goal, you know, the top of the mountain, you know, somewhere in the middle of it, we notice that things are starting to slip a little bit. And then eventually it just totally gets out of control, and what was intended to be a positive thing ends up being disastrous because we lost control of the process, if we ever indeed had control of the process. Now, keep those things in the back of your mind. Let me give you one more thing in terms of an organizational chart for planning. And then we'll talk about a planning model. But here's an organizational chart for planning. It seems to me that the people that are ultimately responsible for the plan are what I call the planning committee. I believe the planning committee should include the chief executive officer of the organization, the board of trustees, again, depending upon various countries. I understand, like, for example, in the United Kingdom, that the Board of Trustees tends to take a less active role in planning, and they leave the responsibility of planning to the administration and not necessarily to the Board of Trustees. They take on a more fiduciary responsibility. But whatever the case might be, it's the people that are clearly involved in creating the direction of the organization. So it could be administration, some key staff members, certainly people that are trusted and who have been involved in the direction of the organization. In a church setting, it would be pastoral leadership and maybe the deacons or the elders, depending upon how the church governance is handled in the denomination or the church body of which you're a part. Now, there typically are two areas where planning occurs. First of all, as it relates to your mission, we need to plan as it relates to our mission. And secondly, there are what I call five critical areas. And I'm going to talk about those five areas in just a few minutes. But first of all, let's talk about mission, because I think this is where planning starts. And mission statements in an organization tend to be somewhat unique. Let me kind of walk you through a mission statement. One of the organizations that we work with internationally is Habitat for Humanity. Some of you are familiar with that organization. And we do a lot of training for Habitat affiliates around the world, and they have a unique mission statement. Typically, mission statements are sentences, usually long sentences, with different clauses, usually separated by commas. Each one of those clauses kind of taking an independent thought and expressing, you know, its relationship to the whole. For example, in the case of Habitat for Humanity, their mission statement reads like this: We work in partnership with God and people everywhere from every walk of life, comma. That's a clause. It's an independent clause. It essentially states one of the things that they are committed as an organization to do, working in partnership with God and with people everywhere from every walk of life. The next clause is to build and renovate homes, comma. Another independent thought. That's another thing that they do. To create community, comma, so that people can become all that God intended for them to be, period. So you have four clauses, four things that people at some point in time felt were important to include in the mission of that organization. Working in partnership with God and people everywhere, building and renovating homes, creating community so that people could become all that God intended for them to be. And usually in most organizations, mission is irrelevant. Now let me state that again, because you know I think it's a very, very important point. A lot of organizations, if not all organizations, have a mission statement. But my question is, how relevant is that mission statement to what it is that happens every day in your organization? It should be very relevant. Everything that you do should be driven by mission. But unfortunately, mission statements in our country, for example, are developed for two primary purposes. You know, most organizations would have a mission statement, but they were developed for two purposes. One was to satisfy incorporation requirements. In other words, in America, if you're going to incorporate as a nonprofit, you have to have a mission statement. And another reason why mission statements are created in a lot of nonprofit organizations in America is because many of them are accredited by outside agencies. For instance, a school might be accredited by an accrediting association, and the accrediting association is going to require evidence of a mission statement. So typically, mission statements are required because of incorporation or accreditation. Well, you know, years ago, we used to get requests from people. It wouldn't be unusual for me to sit in my office and have the phone ring and somebody's calling from someplace and they're saying, Jerry, could you send us a sample mission statement of a church? I said, yeah, I'll do that. And I go into my filing cabinet and I come up with four or five mission statements that various churches around the country are using, and I send it over to my friend who asked me to see a mission statement. Well, you know, lo and behold, usually about 3 or 4 months later, I see a brochure from that church. And I kind of look at the brochure and it has a mission statement in it, and I look at it and it's exactly, precisely like one that I sent them. And I'll say, I might even call them on the phone. I say, well, you know, that's really interesting. I got your brochure and I read your mission statement and it looks a lot like the one that I sent you from XYZ Church. And they say, oh, Jerry, it is. It's the same one. In fact, we called them because we liked the way it sounded so much that we called them and asked them if we could use it. And they said, oh, certainly, go ahead and use it. And so we just incorporated it as our own. See, they didn't take any ownership in it. And basically, it doesn't necessarily drive everything that they do. They just kind of liked the sound of it. It kind of flowed nice, and it kind of sounded nice, and so let's just kind of make it our own. And so they didn't really own it. And I think every single aspect of your organization needs to be planned, including your mission statement, and that means every clause needs to be planned in terms of what it is that you intend to do within your organization to accomplish those objectives. Let me make a statement, and I want you to hear this because I think it's a very, very important statement. I think the difference between goodness and greatness in an organization is probably not all that costly. In other words, you know, a lot of organizations have the view that if we have a new building, then we can be successful. Or if we have something, you know, that we don't have now, you know, that costs a lot of money, then that's all we need in order to have a greater impact in what it is that we're doing. And I believe that that's probably wrong in most instances. That really the difference between being a great organization and just a mediocre organization is determined on how well you do your mission, which oftentimes doesn't cost that much. It becomes more an intentionality issue. We're going to start doing things more intentional to accomplish particular objectives. And being intentional doesn't necessarily have a dollar sign attached to it, at least to the extent that building a new building might. Okay, now over here we have five critical areas.
And I think every strategic plan needs to address these five critical areas. All right, the first of them is facilities. And not necessarily in order. I don't mean to put that in because that's the most important. But many of us, you know, will need facilities to more effectively accomplish what it is that God's called us to do. We may need, if we're a church, we may need a church building at some point in time. I was just talking to a group right before I came up here, down in the patio below, and they need a new office building, a place where they can conduct business and direct their ministries from that they feel they don't have right now. And they're saying, well, we need a new office building. Okay, so they need facilities. We have, secondly, what I call curriculum, and while that may have an academic tone to it, the realities are churches have curriculum, don't they? It's what the pastor preaches on Sunday. He basically has assessed the needs of the congregation. He preaches a series of sermons that basically reflect how he perceives their needs and encourages people to respond accordingly. Sunday school curriculum is basically designed to accomplish, you know, particular purposes. What you do in small groups, if you have a lot of small cell groups that meet outside the church during the week, the curriculum that you use there has an intended purpose and so forth and so on. So curriculum needs to be planned. Co-curricular activities. When I was in school, I played sports. You know, if you went to my school, you didn't have to play sports. It wasn't something that was required. But the realities are, I look back at that time in my life, and I realized that my participation in competitive athletics really helped develop me as a person. My character has kind of taken on a different perspective as a result of that experience. And so while it's not required, you know, in an organization, for instance, a church, to take a short-term missions trip, as many of our churches do, while that may not be required, we realize that if people participate, it enables us to give a more multidimensional completion or fulfillment to the mission to which we've committed. Then you have personnel. You need to plan, you know, people. What kind of people do we need in order to get done what it is that we need to get done? You want the right people. And it may be that you're looking for a youth pastor. You know, your church is looking for a youth pastor, or you're looking for a new faculty member at your college or whatever. And you realize that there's a right kind of person. There's a person that's going to, you know, relate well to other people on the faculty or staff. There's the right kind of person that's going to be the best person for our young people in terms of where it is they might be. And so you're looking for the right person. You're not just looking for somebody with a degree from seminary who can come to your school or to your church and fulfill a role, but you're looking for the right kind of person that's going to enable you to more effectively fulfill mission. So you see, everything that we do is kind of driven by this, isn't it? Your mission statement. And then finally, you have to deal with size issues. How big are we going to be? And you know how big you need to be? You need to be as big as you need to be in order to be accomplish what it is you've committed yourself to do. That's how big you need to be. And so it may be that your college needs to be 1,000 students because that's how big you need to be in order to be able to fulfill the vision that God has given to you in terms of ministering to people and taking their roles in the place where they need to take their roles. So you need to be as big as you need to be in order to accomplish what it is that God's called you to do. If you live in a community and you're the only church that's there in that community, maybe the community is 70,000 or 100,000 and you're only the only evangelical church there, then you may need to be larger than what you are now. And so you may need to make plans accordingly. So keep this in the back of your mind. And now let me give you the model. That's kind of a long introduction to a model which is relatively simple at one level, and I think somewhat profound at another. And it involves 8 steps. And I believe that to the extent that you understand these 8 steps, it's going to make life a whole lot simpler for you. Let me explain the 8 steps. The first one is creating a profile. Whatever you're planning, whether it be a segment of your mission statement or planning to build a new facility, a new sanctuary for your church or whatever, where you begin is by creating a profile. And a profile is a picture of the ideal. It's a picture of the ideal. Let me give you an example. Let's say that you're getting ready to build a new building, you know, a new science building for your college, or a new church building for your congregation. The question that you'd need to answer is this: if this building was perfect in enabling us to do what it is that we do, then what would it look like? How big would it be? What kind of rooms would it have? What would those rooms, you know, be used for? In other words, we'd want to get a picture of the ideal situation. If you have a mission objective, for example, in the case of Habitat for Humanity, they want to create community. Well, that sounds good, but what does community look like? I mean, if you were to see community and if you were to experience community, what would it look like? I suspect it would engage people together. And so community in a building community might be a community building, someplace where people can come together. I mean, community takes on a dimension when we start to define it and actually see it, you know, the end result. So the process of planning always begins with creating a profile. If you're planning an event, if this event was perfect, what would it look like? How would someone leave? I think that's a wonderful question to ask as far as churches are concerned. If you were 100% effective in ministering to a group of people in your congregation that you've identified as being an important group to minister to, let's say it's single parents. Richard and I were having this conversation this morning at breakfast. If you looked at single parents as a group within your congregation that you really want to minister to, then how would you respond to this question? If we were 100% successful in ministering to our single parents, what would they look like? What would they know? How would we effectively minister to them? And you might say, well, they'd know that there's a support network out there to support them. They would know that there are certain things that fathers and mothers need to teach, and if you're the single parent and if you're not one or the other, then the reality is how can you make sure that your child is not deprived the opportunity of getting the information and getting the help and getting the support that they would need from someone that's not a part of the family. In other words, they would know that we care for them. They would know that the resources are being made available to them by our congregation because we want to minister to them in a very unique way. So let's say that we create a picture of what the ideal looks like, the profile, and then, number two, we assess, or assessment. And I want you to think of assessment and grading it in terms of either an A, a B, a C, or a D. So let's say that you're looking at your single parents and you're looking at the profile. Here's a picture of the ideal. This is what we want all of our single parents to look like if we were 100% successful in accomplishing what it is we've committed ourselves to do. Well, how are you going to grade yourself? How well are you doing? You say, well, I think we're probably a C. I mean, we don't match it perfectly. I mean, we're a far piece away from what it is that we really would like to be. We're not a B. I'm not sure that we're there. That's kind of above average, and I don't see ourselves as being above average. I'd see ourselves as probably average. You know, we're doing something, but we're not necessarily, you know, doing as much as we could. So give yourself a grade. Number three is quantify. And quantification basically answers the question why. Why did you give yourself a C and not a B? Why'd you give yourself a B and not an A? Okay? And usually what you'll do is you'll say, okay, for these five reasons is the reason that I gave ourselves a C and not a B. You know, we're not doing these things. Let me just say that the ultimate goal of the strategic plan is to come up with a quantified list, a list that identifies things that need to happen. Any strategic plan that lacks quantification is really nothing more than a good idea. You know, there's a lot of good ideas out there. We'd like to be the largest church and the most impacting church in our community. And that's your goal. That's your vision. Well, if you don't have a plan to get there that has quantifiable steps outlined in terms of what it is that needs to happen this year, next year, and the years thereafter, the realities are that's just a good idea. It's a great idea. It'd be nice if it happens, but the realities are it probably won't because you don't have a plan to achieve it.
And so what this plan or what this model does is it helps us to begin the process of identifying where our deficiencies are so that we can plan to address them. And in this particular example, what we have here is we have these five reasons why we gave ourselves the grade that we did. Number four, prioritization. In other words, of all the things that you identified as being deficient, which are the most mission critical? You say, oh, well, that's easy. Number four is the most important. Because if we're going to effectively minister to single parents, then we need to have a common bond between that parent, that single parent, and our church in the person of Jesus Christ. And here's a parent that doesn't even know the Lord. So one of the objectives, obviously, is to make sure that we have the opportunity of presenting the gospel of Christ and the claims of Christ on their life and give them every opportunity to respond in faith to what it is that the Lord has done. Now, that doesn't mean you can't do other things, because some of the other things that you do might give them, you know, an attraction to Christ that would cause them to respond in faith, recognizing, you know, the importance of that personalization or that personal relationship. So you may say, that's the most important, this would be next, this would be next, this would be next, and this would be next. So now you have a prioritized list of deficiencies that you need to address in your plan. Yes.
So, in order to attract the best, we would need to work on finding the funds and developing a network and supporting this. So, that might take some time.
Right. Well, kind of hold the thought on that one, because I think I'll answer that. Because some of these are going to involve dollars. You have certain dollars that are available to you now that you know that you have available because you have annual operating budgets and you may have some money that you can allocate towards, you know, teacher salaries and so forth. And there's another sense in which you might be able to do things through developmental activity, which is what we're going to be talking tomorrow about in the network, to generate larger amounts of money at various times within the context of the developmental year that would give you additional resources. And there's even another answer to that question, which I think we'll get into more detail with tomorrow. But that's a very relevant question. But I think, you know, practically speaking, that you could probably plan quite precisely for about 3 years where you can be really, really precise in terms of this is what it is we're going to do. Then, you know, after 3 years, you tend to be a little bit more general, but you can establish a direction. In other words, we need to, you know, we're going to need to expand, you know, land. We don't know how much, but we know that, you know, that's going to be an issue that we're going to have to address in the fourth year. There are any number of reasons why that's the case. First of all, there are things that change over which we have no control. Demographic things may change. They were in the case of America, you have, you know, September the 11th that's thrown in, which kind of throws everything off, and we have to kind of readjust our plans based upon unique situations that have developed. So while you can't be as precise beyond 3 or 4 years, you can still create a general direction that's going to move you to where it is that you ultimately want to be in terms of fulfilling a vision. Fifth is once you prioritize this list, then you need to plan. Okay, how are we going to get it done? And put it into a component or a plan that basically says, okay, this year we're going to do these three things, next year we're going to do these three things, and so forth and so on. Then you need to... Excuse me? Four is prioritization. Five is plan. Six is organization. In other words, you have to organize yourself to get the plan accomplished. And tomorrow in the network and tomorrow up here, we're going to be talking about organization. And then seven, you need to implement the plan. And then number eight, you need to hold yourself accountable to the plan. And that's through regular or an annual evaluation. How well are you doing? So you need to hold yourself accountable to the plan, that this is the plan we've committed ourselves to. You know, how well are we doing on a regular basis? Well, I think accountability is probably done through evaluation, you know, annual evaluation. And usually, sometimes I use the word accountability here, sometimes I word the evaluation. But I think annually, at least annually, minimally on an annual basis, it needs to be assessed in terms of how well, you know, you've accomplished the specific objectives that you've allocated for any given year. Now, you know, that's a pretty simple model, but let me tell you how practical it is. I think you're probably seeing it already. One of the things that I have done in churches is I encourage churches to identify critical groups of people within the congregation. And usually most people will fall into a variety of groups. I did this in my church. I tried to answer the question, which group of people do I most closely relate to in the church where I worship? You see, I fall into a lot of categories. I'm a senior citizen. I'm a father. I'm a grandfather. I'm a business owner. There's any number of categories that I'd fall in, and there are other people in my congregation that are part of those categories. But probably the best way to come up with what category you're most closely or the group that you most closely relate to is it can be determined by the group that you most closely gravitate to when given the opportunity of, you know, visiting, you know, maybe during a break between services and you're getting a cup of coffee and you see some people standing. What group of people are you more likely to go to? And it may be the small group of which you're a part. Maybe that's the group that you most closely relate to. Or, you know, a group of businessmen. I tend to hang around with a bunch of older guys my age, you know, who are involved in business. And they have their own businesses. And we just kind of talk a lot about things that are happening in our lives. Okay. Well, think of that group and think of a church, and they might say, well, how could we most effectively minister to this group of men or this group of people? And if we were ideal in fulfilling what it is that God's called us to do in the lives of these men, what would they look like? And then on the basis of that, you can begin to determine how well you're doing through assessment, and you can also determine where you're deficient so that you can begin planning a more effective way of ministering to those men. You could look at, you know, the ideal of a segment of your mission statement. If we were 100% successful in ministering to people in this particular way, creating community, what would it look like? How well are we doing? Assessment. Why did we give ourselves the grade that we did for these three reasons? Then what are we going to do about it? And then we start planning. So there's it's an entire, you know, if you're going to do an event, if you're planning an event, you're going to have a banquet, and you're going to bring people to the banquet, and you're going to have a wonderful banquet, and the purpose of this banquet is to kind of kick off the church year. You know, it's September, it's October, and we're getting ready to think through what it is that we're, as a church, are going to do this year. Well, if this event was 100% successful, this kickoff event, this vision banquet, or whatever you want to call it, then how would you want people to leave? What would you want them to walk away with? A level of expectation, an understanding of what is going to be made available to them so that they can plug into various opportunities that we're going to create and so forth. In other words, it's pretty easy to do. But most of us don't do that. Most of us don't think about the end result. If you're preaching a sermon, how do you want people to walk away? What do you want them to walk away with? And it's going to help you to determine, first of all, what it is that you say, and secondly, what kinds of instructions that you give people, you know, as you conclude your sermon. Let me share with you three or four things that I think are very, very important for you to think through as you're evaluating what it is that God's spoken to you about today. Okay, let me give you another illustration real quickly. Is that, you know, Sue and I were driving down the road one day, and I said to her, you know, we were on a long trip. And I said, oh, honey, I've got this great idea. And she said, well, what would that be? And I said, let's profile the perfect husband. Guys don't go there. I mean, I wouldn't recommend that. But I kind of learned my lesson, I guess. And so she says, oh, that would be fun. Well, now I realized I probably am in some trouble. And so the first three things out of her lips, I know I'm going to get an A. In fact, the reason that I did the exercise in the very beginning was the fact that I thought I was going to get all A's. And she'd realize what an incredible prize that she had. And Well, didn't quite work out that way, because as we're driving down the road, she says, well, you know, the perfect husband never reacts to me. I said, what do you mean by that? She says, that's the point, honey. She says, you've got an opinion on everything. And you don't mind sharing your opinion with anybody that you see, and sometimes they want to hear it, and sometimes they don't, and sometimes I don't want to hear your opinion. And she says, and then there's another thing. And I think, oh my, I really realized that I was in trouble here. And she says, there's another thing. And I says, what would that be? And she said, you know, the perfect husband doesn't try to solve my problems. She says, you know, honey, she says, I'm reasonably intelligent. I have a doctorate. You don't. I says, well, that kind of hurts. I mean, that's a little insensitive, dear. She says, but, you know, I'm reasonably intelligent. She says, I know. You know, the other day, she starts telling me about something that happened that she remembered that happened, you know, probably 3 or 4 years prior to that event. She says, but you came home and I mentioned a problem that I was having. Well, before I'd even gotten it out of my lips, you were on the telephone talking to somebody, and you were kind of working out all the details, and I kind of hang up the phone. She says, well, I've got that problem worked out. What's next? And she says, I'm not asking you to solve my problems. She says, I realize that some of the things that I sometimes say are crazy, and they don't make an awful lot of sense, and that's okay. I'm just asking you to listen and to be there and to kind of help me to work through this. Well, you know, we kind of get through the process. And so the next thing is we go through an assessment. Well, you know, I got some A's. I really did. I have to admit, I got 3 or 4 A's. And I got some B's, and I got 2 C-minuses. Now, you probably figured out where the C-minuses were. And after I get over the hurt of having 2 C-minuses, I asked her, I says, well, honey, what can I do? And she says, well, honey, you just need to be there. And I don't mean just physically there. I mean, you need to be there. You know, sometimes even when you're there, you're not here, you know. And that you know, that kind of is irritating. So I just want you to be there. And I just want you to listen. You don't need to respond. You don't have to have the answer. That's okay. I'm just wanting you to listen to me. I just want you to be there and help me to work through some issues and kind of guide me and, you know, think through the process with me. And, well, I took that to heart, quite frankly. I listened to her and I heard what she said. Well, about 6 months later, I'm coming home from a business trip. And I sit down in our kitchen, and we're having dinner together. And I said to her, I says, well, honey, I says, how was your week? And she says, oh, it was a good week, except for Thursday. And she starts telling me about Thursday, and she had an experience where she was kind of in a meeting, and somebody asked a question, and she responded to the question. Sue's a psychologist, and she's really insightful, and they were talking about a particular need, and the question was asked, you know, how they the group felt that need should be responded to, and everybody, it was kind of like a person that's really bleeding, you know, and everybody was trying to figure out ways to put bandages on where she was bleeding or if they were bleeding, when in reality, you know, they were hemorrhaging somewhere inside, and I think Sue kind of discerned that. I have a lot of respect for her insight, and she said, well, I don't think we're talking about the right thing, and when she made her suggestion, the person just really put her down. He says, well, I don't know where that's coming from. That has absolutely no irrelevance, and that's just foolish, and let's move on. And I said, oh, my word, how did you feel? And she said, I felt horrible. She said, I felt put down. I felt embarrassed. I felt dumb. And she told me all that. And I could understand why she would have felt all those emotions. And so we talked about it for about 15 or 20 minutes. Well, as we were talking, you know, the meal was over, and she's starting to, you know, clean the plates off. And we're just sitting there talking. I said, well, honey, I need to, you know, go take a break and work in the office for about 10 or 15 minutes. But I think if I have 15 or maybe 20 minutes at the most, I can get all the work done that I need to get done, and then we can just spend some time together. And she says, okay, you go do that. I'll just put the dishes up and clean the kitchen. So I said, okay. So I walked into my office. I'm working away. I look up, and there she is. She's standing in the doorway, big crocodile tears coming down her cheeks. And I said, well, honey, what's wrong? She said, that was just the best conversation we've ever had. I'm saying, best conversation. I never said anything. She says, that's why it was the best conversation we've ever had. But I think the point is, you know, that it was something that resulted from just really understanding, you know, planning to be a little bit more sensitive in the ways that I really wanted to be as a husband. Now, let's kind of go through this real quickly because we're really moving towards the end of our time. Who does what? And I think this is going to answer some of your questions as it relates to some things that were said earlier. In this particular example, let me suggest to you, you know, given the model that I gave you here, here's the planning committee. Here are the mission and the five critical areas. Okay, I think it's the responsibility of the planning committee to create the profiles. One of the things that our company does, and I used to do this a lot years ago, I don't do it much anymore. We have staff people that do that for us, but we have a whole division of our company that just does strategic planning for ministries. And but usually it begins with a retreat somewhere. And I always used to like to go to these retreats because they were really at nice places. You know, they'd always go to the river or to the lake or to the mountains or someplace. And it was always kind of fun to go there. And the purpose of that two-day meeting, which was usually a Friday night and an all-day Saturday, the purpose of that meeting was nothing more than creating profiles for each of these critical areas where planning was going to occur. In other words, we'd sit down with a planning committee, we'd sit down in groups, and we'd kind of hammer out these profile statements. And then we wouldn't leave Saturday until all of them were complete. And, in an ideal world, we'd encourage the planners to, wordsmith them so they sounded right. And then we'd actually ask them, or I would typically ask them, to make those profiles a matter of minutes. In other words, make them official. You know, put them into the corporate minutes so it becomes the position of the board or the leadership team so that it has a sense of officiality, if you please. Steps number two and three are done by task forces. Now, a task force is a group of people that are assembled together to accomplish a task. And the task, specifically in this case, is assessing our organization in relationship to the profile and quantifying our deficiencies. Now, let me give you some suggestions. Remember the three reasons or the four reasons why plans fail? Well, now I'm going to help you a little bit in understanding some of the questions that maybe Frank asked or was inferring in his question. You know, first of all, here's a recommendation. The chairperson of the task force, the person that leads the task force, I believe should be a member of the original planning committee. In other words, make him the original or a member of the original planning committee. And the reason for that is hopefully obvious. You know, sometimes in their deliberations, people are going to look at a profile and they're going to say, well, what do they mean by this? I mean, what's the relevance of this? And a person that was there involved in the preparation of that task, that profile, is going to be able to answer that question. If he wasn't there, then they're going to have to figure it out themselves, and who knows what they're going to conclude. So it just makes sure that the thing doesn't get out of control. Remember, we don't want the process to get out of control. Number two, it is my recommendation, as this task force is assembled, that the task force chairman, before he ever asks a person to serve on that committee, profiles what that ideal task force would look like. In other words, what kind of people need to be on the task force, number one, and then number two, who would be some likely candidates, and I believe those candidates need to be submitted to the original planning committee for their approval. Again, we don't want to get the wrong people. That's what Frank's question. How do we make sure we get the right people? Well, don't ask anyone until you have the consensus of the group. Here's a good place for consensus of the planning committee to make sure that we're getting people that are going to be really positive contributors to the process. Now, after they quantify, notice that we don't give the responsibility of prioritization to the task force. We give it to the planning committee. Why? Because typically in an average planning process, you have 9 task forces functioning at the same time, all of whom come up with deficiencies. Well, you only have limited resources to be able to address any plan that's going to be created, and so it becomes the responsibility of the planning committee that knows what those resources are to allocate them in accomplishing objectives so that you can produce a plan that you can accomplish. Because as you accomplish plans, where do people go in the attitude continuum? Towards encouragement and hope and enthusiasm. But if you create plans that are never accomplished, where do people go in the attitude continuum? Discouragement, frustration, apathy, and eventually cynicism. The planning committee produces the plan. The planning committee and the task forces, okay, now work together in organizing, implementing, and evaluating regularly the plan. This provides buy-in opportunities for your constituency. They have the opportunity of buying into the plan, learning about it. They have things to offer that are very valuable and important for you to hear. So those are things that are very, very important. So I think this is a process that essentially engages the right people. It doesn't take very long. Interestingly enough, this process, depending upon how big it is, should never go more than 6 to 9 months, and we have large organizations where it does take about that long because of just the immensity of the size of the organization. But for the average church, I think this can probably be done in 1 to 3 months. These meetings don't take long. Usually it's one or two meetings unless you're getting ready to build a brand new building, and this you've got a building committee that's basically helping you to do those things. Well, we've got to finish up, and I'm sorry, I always have more information than what I have time, and that's the case today. But we do have an evaluation form that you've been given. I hope that, have you been given it already? Okay. They already know the speech. But it's important to get the evaluation forms, and I hope that you will fill them out. And if you have constructive criticism on things that we might have been able to do better in terms of sharing information, please let us know that. The goal of the evaluation forms is to really help us to be better at what it is we do in forthcoming show prawns that may be scheduled in the future. Tomorrow at our session, we'll kind of revisit this a little bit. If you come up to this workshop, we're going to talk about organization. But there is a lot of relevance as we transfer data that comes from here to the organizational process. And I think this is a wonderful precursor to the things that we're going to be talking about tomorrow.